From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, in London, Giles Morgan. Giles, come in, over.
Hey, Grant, how are you?
Mate, I'm very, very well indeed. Nice to see you slumming it with the ordinary people instead of global sporting superstars and legends.
No, it's nice to be with real people. People without a trophy cabinet. I feel much more at home.
People whose but name you like, can remember.
I'm a Fulham fan. We didn't even bother building a trophy cabinet. Also joining us, and you heard him chipping in there before we'd even introduced him to you, is the chippy one himself, presumably
El at Chippo. Near
in or by the lake. Roger Mitchell, Rog, come
yeah,
in.
I'm good. I've just had a strawberry milkshake delivered to me, so all's good with the world.
Who by?
My wife.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, so lockdown seems to be going okay for you then,
yeah,
Rog?
Yeah, it's going super well, super well. The world is
your goal for, how's your golf, Rog?
Yeah, I was just saying it's working on that new swing in to in. It's my forearms are now the size of Popeye because I've never used them before.
Now I have. It's funny, I've got big forearms from my boarding school.
One right. Big forearm anyway. Rog, you, when you say you're into in swing, is that into the trees and into the pond, yeah, and into the long grass?
Yeah, something like that. It is rather depressing because, you know, as you know, when you're playing with the professional, it's all beautiful. And then you go into the first one is a duck hook into the trees.
A duck hook. All right. Well, listen, chaps, this week it's not the three of us nattering and sounding off about things that irritate and delight us. We have a very special guest joining us this week. Rog, why don't you let the viewers know who is going to be joining us shortly?
Sure. Today we've got Laurie Pinto joining us. Laurie is somebody of our generation, a bit background like yourself, Grant, from the investment banking world, been involved in all kinds of transactional type work, M&A, restructurings, turnarounds, spin-offs. And he's developed a little bit of a niche in doing all of that in the sports field. I met Laurie a few years ago. I think it was principally around what he was trying to do with AC Milan at the time that the various Asian buyers were looking at it. And we continue to chat about what's happening in the world of sport finance. He's originally an Arsenal fan because he comes from North London. Probably was closer to Spurs than Arsenal, but followed Arsenal. And then his life took him into the more interesting worlds of chess for money and poker for money. And I think we'll investigate both of those, Grant.
We most certainly will. I have to say that does remind me, you're talking about his work with AC Milan. The greatest Sunday league team name I ever heard, Rog, was a Sunday team from Guildford in Surrey, who called themselves A3 Milan, which I just thought was absolutely fabulous. All right, well, listen, let's not waste any more time. Let's welcome Laurie to the show, shall we? Well, Laurie, welcome to Are You Not Entertained? Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's funny, you know, in doing the prep for this, it turns out it's, as someone said, it's a small world, though you wouldn't want to paint it. And it looks like you and I have a lot of friends in common, friends that probably both of us would like to disown. So perhaps you and I should kind of stick with each other and disavow everybody else. But perhaps you could give people a little personal background of you, because you've had an interesting career, an interesting life, and you've done some things that many of us would never even think about doing.
After an intro like that, I'm kind of laughing nervously about our mutual friends and maybe change the subject now, really.
All silence, don't worry.
Yeah, I grew up in North London, actually about 500 yards from Spurs is where I went to school, in Edmonton. But I was a gooner as a kid. We felt comfortable in the 1-0 to the Arsenal rather than losing 5-3 and all that glamour and all that stuff. We just knew where we stood and it was great. But as a kid, I got sort of into solitary sports. So I was very involved when I was early on in chess when I was 11 and started at 11 and 16. I was British champion for my sins. But there's
British
no money
champion.
In chess. Yeah, British
Jesus.
Under 16 champion. Yeah, there wasn't anyone else playing it, Rog. You know?
Well, that guy Nigel, what was his name? Nigel Short.
Short.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't quite good enough then.
Right? Amateur.
Yeah. Then he went on to become rich and famous at it. But I figured I'd peaked early, right? So went back into a normal life. Spent for my sins 30 years in banking, investment banks, spent 9 years between London and Beijing on a business between the two, which I left about 5 years ago, fortunately in the hands of Everbright, the fifth biggest bank in China. And since then, I've focused on sport deals, sport M&A, sport restructurings. And to be frank, I didn't really know a lot about sport from the business side of it. But I spent about a year and a half just going around all the biggest clubs in the world, around the biggest agents in the world, around the biggest finances in the world, and figured out actually not many people knew anything about sport either. And so therefore, just applying a little bit of common sense to it could get you quite a long way. So I was reasonably fortunate that I ran into a few people at the right time, applied a little bit of logic to it. And for whatever reason, right now is a really exciting time for figuring out what's going on in the future. You've got to have a macro view and you've got to have a micro view. And that's what I do. I help guide people through it from this stage. And that's both equity, debt, bridging, mezz, financing, transfer funding, and all of the above. And what's difficult is the cost of money should be going down because interest rates have gone down, but actually the perception of risk has gone up. So the cost of money, the real cost of money, is actually higher. But we're all believers sport's coming back, and therefore it's just a question of figuring out your risk and reward. And that's what I do.
Yeah, Laurie, I want to take you back a little bit because there's a part of your life that one of those friends who shall remain anonymous clued me in on that I want to go back to, and that pertains to the chess and a little period you spent in Paris as a young man. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that part of your life.
Absolutely not, mate. There might be children listening to this. I have to say I used to play a lot, and I used to have play a lot of chess for money, but I ended up giving
for
that
money.
Up. Yeah,
for money?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's very similar to how people play backgammon for money with contra dice, and you bet on it. But now I actually go to Vegas once or twice a year and play poker and play medium to high stakes poker. Is my vice, and I have
that's Texas Hold'em.
Yeah, mainly Texas Hold'em, and I'm a big believer in odds playing. And I think it's really interesting. People talk about risk management and risk. Right?
Yeah.
In poker, there's a very famous book called The Billionaire. The Professor, the Billionaire, and the Suicide King. And the professor was a guy called Howard Lederer, who's the world poker champion. Okay. He looked like a professor, he had a long beard, looked very distinguished. The billionaire was a guy called Andy Beals, who was a Texas savings and loans guy. Yeah. And the Suicide King
I've
king.
Actually met Andy Beal, fascinating guy.
Yeah, he is. He's an extraordinary guy. And the Suicide King is the King of Diamonds. If you look at the King of Diamonds, he's stabbing himself. The professor meets the billionaire. The billionaire says to the professor, you're the world number one ranked poker player, you're the world champion. How much have you ever made playing poker? The guy says, $5 million. Says, okay, I'll play you heads up poker for $5 million.
Fuck's sake.
The professor takes the bet. So he thinks, if I was Tiger Woods and I'm playing golf against a good amateur, I'll beat him every time over a golf course.
Yeah,
Roger Federer at tennis, world number one, I'll beat you at tennis. And then the doubts start creeping in. This is a really wealthy guy. He drops $5 million. It's like, you or I dropping a pound coin down the back of the settee. It annoys you, but it's, you know, you're not going to have a sleepless night about it. And this book is the risk management of that bet. A poker player will bet everything he's got on his own skill if he thinks the odds are marginally in his favor. A guy playing the stock market, an event-driven guy, will not double up unless it's 85-15 in his favor. Okay? And I'm a numbers guy. When I look at anything, I think in terms of cold, hard numbers. Yep. I'm a quant at everything I do. Okay? And when I look at football, the biggest challenge I've always found is most people really don't analyze big data properly. They don't think about the data at all. They play lip service to it. They'll talk data, 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 money ball, money ball, money ball. But actually, very few of them even know who their fans are. Just have no way of knowing. There's no way of tracking it. It's just incredible in the year 2020 that most clubs communicate with their fans at best by email. It's quite extraordinary. And that's where I see a lot of room for using tech in a smart way. And I know, Rog, this is one of your big things, right?
But not as much as Giles, but yeah.
And Giles is even bigger big thing, right?
Yeah.
But it's amazing how people just haven't really thought through OTT, multi-layer streaming, and applied it now with the mobile phone. See, I would argue people talk about viewing figures of sport going down. I think they're actually going up. But I think the millennials just consume sport in a very different way.
Different channels. Business. Different channels.
It's like the music business. It's never been more popular listening to music, but it's a different model. Same in the sport. Very few have realized that, Laurie. Very few.
But very few have figured out a way, even if they do realize it, of how to really access it and really monetize it. Okay? And I use monetize very loosely, right? A lot of clubs now are going to struggle. The amount of money going into big level sponsorship is going to be hurt. There's no doubt about it. And so I'm not worried about the big clubs, right? The big clubs are the big clubs. The big six are playing their own sport, okay, commercially.
Yep.
Everybody else needs to figure out their business plan, right, and have a real plan. And what I find when people look at buying football clubs is most of the buyers don't really have a plan. They act like they've got a plan.
So why are they buying it then? Let's get into that. Why are they buying it? Because I agree with you completely. Every time somebody's come to me in my career and said, I want to do this, I say, what are you buying the club for? And they give you a bullshit answer about whatever. But the reality is something completely different, where, to take your point, Laurie, they haven't worked out the risk odds. They haven't worked it out, and then they go through a honeymoon period where they think the world loves them and the fans want to hang out with them, and then we all know how it ends, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the honeymoon period is the catch. I think there's two groups. I think there's the vanity trade guys that just wanted it because it was a trophy. You know, I spent quite a number of years between London and China, and trust me, when a solar panel manufacturer wanted to own a club in the UK, he had a slightly different motivation to everybody else, right? we had the wave of Russians. We've had the wave of Chinese. You know, we've got some potentially fresh money Arabs coming into the business. But if you look at the real wave of interested parties at the moment, it's Americans, okay? It's all American money with the odd exception. And there's two reasons, I think, driving the Americans. One is the valuation of franchises in the States has gone through the roof. Okay, you look at any NBA, NFL, or even the last 2 years, look at the valuation of MLS clubs, and it's gone up stratospheric.
Yeah.
So in absolute terms, everything in Europe looks cheap. Just looks cheap. Okay. The second thing is the growth in media money has directly correlated with the valuations. And as media money has gone up, soconomics, so has the money gone up. As the money's gone up, the valuations have gone up. They're the buyers. And what unfortunately has happened, in my opinion, is you have to have an individual plan for each club. No two clubs have the same structure, demographics, culture, history, and business opportunity. Okay? And that's where I think a lot of people struggle I get a lot of people say, do you know what? Let's just be an academy. Let's try and pick good kids. Okay. Tell me a club that doesn't want to pick good kids. Okay. I'd like to meet them. Okay. Maybe Liverpool and Manchester United in recent years haven't really bought kids. Mourinho very rarely gave anyone under 22 a game, did he? It happens occasionally. Okay. But everybody else wants to breed their own talent. Okay. Check. Let's assume we're all doing that. How do you make a business sustainable? If you're going to buy anything, any company doing anything, you're assuming you want to make it sustainable. You want it to run to make money or to create some value. What are your income lines? Okay. Television money, right? As a club, you can't influence that. Yeah. It's out of your hands. You can't influence it. Okay. Sponsorship. Yes, you definitely can influence it, right? Other commercial revenue, season tickets. You try putting the price of season tickets up in the north of England. No chance. You'll have a riot on your hands. I think the most expensive ticket at Liverpool is still half the price of the cheapest ticket at Arsenal. Okay? I think that's right. So where can you increase your revenue? What can you do to earn more money? Okay? Most Americans talk about stadiums. They talk about occupancy rates. Okay, how many times do I use my stadium? Okay, you know, Spurs just built a stadium. They spent £1 billion on it. They don't even have a roof. Okay, so Spurs aren't worried about occupancy rates because they know it's going to rain 11 months of the year. It could be the biggest white elephant in history. Right, they're going to be renting out Spurs at the same time as Twickenham, Arsenal, Chelsea, Brentford, Harlequins. So they've got no pricing power. Okay, so that's, I think actually there's a lot of interest putting on roofs.
And what you're saying, Laurie, is to come in here is where, and very much they're more advanced than the US, but that sense of first party fan data, knowing your consumer, knowing the fans and knowing everything about them, is the financial model for the future of sport, isn't it? In terms of, as you say, all of the habits, not just having a segmentation of who they are, but how they spend, where they spend, particularly in mobile data, digital data, that has to be where the value lies.
Totally agree. It's digital. It used to be called getting a digital profile of your fan, right? And there's going to be fans that follow certain things certain amounts of the time. But it's all about the big data and the use of the big data and then having the tech over the top of it so you can have the conversation directly with them.
But owned by the rights holder, not owned by Facebook. It has to be first party owned by them.
Correct. Correct. That is the key to this business is you are the owner of your fan. Your fan engages with you. The big challenge with Sky and the television deal is when I see the numbers from it in terms of following and watching, who knows who's really watching? It's great to know they had 12 million or 23 million followers, people watching of a game. But what use is that really to the club once they've got their money? Nothing. What use is that to a sponsor? What does a sponsor want nowadays? What do they really want?
Don't get them started on that, Laurie, please. Please.
they want targeted marketing, don't they? Targeted marketing.
Absolutely. Pinpointed.
You know,
I've often said that in my old role, if I knew then what I know now about the ability to capture data, own data from rights holder, one, the portfolio that I used to run would look very, very different. In fact, it would be entirely different. And also the selection process rather than the meaningless eyeball from television versus absolutely segmented consumers all over the world would have been the business rationale, pure and simple.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're bang on it. And it's amazing how whenever I talk to people about football, they've all read Billy Beane's Moneyball. They all talk about Barnsley. They all talk about the bits related
Brentford.
To it.
Yeah.
Brentford, yeah, Matt, he's done brilliantly, Matt Bierman, in the last couple of years. He had a diabolical start. Diabolical. First 6 or 7 years, look at his numbers. How much money did he lose? 80, 90 million? How many people can wear that kind of lesson? But maybe ask Matt, how's he used big data with his fans, with his audience, with his customers, with his sponsors? It's all been on the pitch for Matt, okay? And I think you find that a lot of a lot of clubs, when they talk about big data, really only apply it to the on the pitch.
Absolutely. And I would say, having one of the businesses I'm involved with is based out of Dallas, so very involved with the Dallas Mavericks, their ability to segment the fan is astonishing in terms of what they know, and therefore the ability for them to trade deals with sponsors, media partners, investors, continues to grow because they have the answer to the business need that all of those constituent needs, which is who is the consumer, and in real time and in dynamic time, what are they doing and when are they doing it and where are they doing it? That's the answer.
I agree. And it's funny, have you ever been to football in China, guys? You've been to a game in China?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Yeah, I have.
It's quite
a few things.
Yeah. Let's start with the football. But like, you go to a game like Guangzhou Evergrande, right? And it's a steamy hot day near Hong Kong. It's boiling hot. It's 35 degrees, 85% humidity. And all the chants are in Chinese, going, wah, 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 wah. And you suddenly think, crikey, that sounds familiar. And they're chanting, oh, when the Saints go marching in, but in Mandarin, okay? And they've taken all the songs they hear on the British TV and they run them over. But I think what's interesting, you go into the stadium and everything in there is Alibaba because it's majority owned by Alibaba. So all the advertising is Alibaba. The intranet is Alibaba. Everything in there is Alibaba. They took the view, why would you rent your space to a non-group corporate? Okay.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Makes fantastic sense, doesn't it? Right. And then, you know, Mike Ashley slagged off for using Sports Direct Stadium. You know, it's kind of.
Yeah. Well, I think people have an inherent bias against Mike Ashley. Any chance they get to throw something at him, they do.
Grant, but I mean, you look at the results that have come out recently. We spoke a little bit with James Yandel on a previous podcast about Newcastle, and not with James, but on my own account, I looked at the numbers about 18 months ago, and it looked a good deal for me. I think that, you know, I think even at today's valuations, you know, you look at what you get it for, 300 million, and you compare it to the valuation of some of the bigger clubs that are 10 times that. I don't see that delta. Do you, Laurie? Do you see that size of differentiation in valuation?
No, I really don't. It's the last sleeping giant. You know, 12 years ago, Newcastle's valuation was the same as Spurs, and actually higher than Barcelona. Okay. You could argue they made a lot of sponsorship mistakes. Wonga probably going on the front of a shirt wasn't the greatest thing you could do if you want to get other sponsors. But you would argue it's got a massive catchment area, fanatical following, big brand. It's probably one of the two in the Premier League that has any chance to catch the big six. Any chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
The challenge it's got, though, as a brand, is it's quite parochial. It isn't global. You know, what I think would be interesting is if someone had to go at monetizing, or thought they could monetize what they thought Sunderland Till I Die has done for the valuation of Sunderland.
Yeah. I know what you mean, but listen. Let's assume that somebody was looking at it, and I think one of the objectives of this podcast is to try and explain to normal folks some of the deals and how they get done. Take us through, because this is the one most people get really confused with, take us through how the Glazers bought Man United and how they've managed through that leverage buyout with pick interest and everything like that to get so much back from it for relatively little outlay. Use that as an example to explain finance and how it approaches a football club like Man United.
Sure. I think maybe let's use it to approach any business where you've got a strong brand and quite a lot of free cash flow.
Exactly.
Okay? The trade worked because they had a cash flow positive business. So in practice, they borrowed 100% of the money from three hedge funds, Perry, Oxif, and Citadel. What would you consider super expensive money?
Okay. Super expensive,
16% interest rates, payment in kind options on the top, and a pretty much a stranglehold on as much free cash flow as possible. They effectively put down almost no cash, if any cash. Okay.
Do you think the fans understand that?
Yes, I think they understood that they put down very little money. And I think that's why they weren't very well liked by the fans. Do I think they understood how little it was? No, I don't think they've got a clue.
Laurie, let me ask you, because this is something that you, when you talked about your thoughts on all this at the top of the show there, really kind of stuck in my head. And that is this, there's a disconnect somewhere between people who are very sound businessmen and who understand the practicalities of quote unquote doing business, who seem to forget all that when it comes to sport, particularly football, to your point, I think you made earlier on.
Yeah.
The fans don't understand the business side of it enough. It's just opaque enough to give them a kind of a sense of unease or a sense of rancor, but they don't really know why when they see the Glazers come in and do that. And they will forget that quite quickly if the team is successful on the pitch. But what is it about football that makes normally very pragmatic businessmen forget almost everything they've learned in business and want to chase that dream? And is it just purely ego, or is there another part to it?
That's a great question. And I think about it a lot. You know, you look at two sort of massive examples in recent years. Randy Lerner at Aston Villa. You know, his family, phenomenally successful family in Cleveland, you know, payment cards, hugely wealthy. And you look at Ellis Short at Sunderland, okay? Yeah. They're the two glaring hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds lost. What did both of these guys have in common? Apart from they were both American. They both thought they could buy success on the pitch. They both read Soconomics and thought, if we just spend loads of money, we'll be okay. Okay? And both of them were massive failures on the pitch. Okay? You know, it's really interesting. I mean, Ellis Short, probably one of the brightest men ever in business. You know, his Lone Star, phenomenally successful business. And he could not get his head round why it had not worked out, okay? And I think you can ask half the people in the Northeast, they'll all have theories on it, but he just backed the wrong people, and he backed them without much substance, okay? Randy Lerner paid the wrong price, okay? He paid the wrong price. When you start off at the wrong price, you've got to buy the right thing at the right price, is always the saying. You've got to be super disciplined.
Absolutely.
And he paid the wrong price. And then they massively underperformed on the pitch. Okay. He sold it out to a Chinese guy who had no money, Tony.
Right. Yeah.
You know, who, and now they've got real sensible guys running it. And it'd be interesting to see how they approach it. They bought it very cheap, but again, they've spent an enormous amount in the transfer market. And I'd argue pretty average players.
But again, you know, Laurie, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because to your point, these guys in business, they wouldn't pay the wrong price, right? I mean, they've done enough of this to know when something's priced wrong. There's something about football. And I had a chat a number of years ago with someone who was thinking of buying a proper football club, a globally well-revered football club. And I had this conversation, what are you doing this for? I mean, these are vanity projects. And he, you know, he ran me through what he saw as the commercial opportunity, and he said this is a fantastic commercial opportunity, and this is going to be one of the best deals I've ever done. And he certainly, during the time he owned the club, had incredible highs, but also incredible lows. And this is one of the smartest men I've ever met in my life. And yet, I think if you sat him down, as hopefully we will do on the podcast at some point, and asked him about this, he would say, I wish I'd never done that. I wish I'd never done it. I got into something that turned into a disaster. I'm just fascinated by what makes people pay the wrong price, particularly for sports teams. And a lot of them have got very, very lucky over the years because they kind of bought them at a point where the sport brand globally went crazy. But still, you know, they got lucky. They a lot of them paid the wrong price. I mean, you've met with these guys, you've spoken to them. Is there anything you can identify that makes it such a common thing?
there is a common theme, right? And I used to have a thing on my desk. It said, I see smart people doing dumb things, right? it's like you could look at it in the hedge fund world. You know, John Paulson did the greatest trade ever of all time. He was offside for 14 months consecutively doing that trade. A most incredible trade to hold on to. And ever since then, he's never replicated it in any way, shape, or form.
Okay? No, not even close.
Not even close. Okay. People believe that because they're successful at business, they can be successful in sports management. Okay. It's just a quirky thing. And I think they don't realize just how much of it is more complicated once you're in it than it is from the outside.
Well, and let me come in there. Something that I used to see in my old role is exactly that. More, in fact, in golf is where some of the most successful business people from around the world would be in the company of the world's top golfers at events that were put on. And these grown people were reduced to schoolboys, is the best way I can put it, in terms of giggling wrecks. And so one of the things, the magic of sport, which does to all of us, is it changes us. It's something that Simon Barnes, the former Times correspondent, writes a lot about, is about the power of sport and what it does to all of us. Is something that it brings us down to a level. And I think for some business people, when they think about the business of sport, they get overtaken by that kind of, there's a magic potion that can affect some people. And I think it can affect some minds.
I agree with that. It is one of the most enigma things. But I suppose if you're a billionaire guy and you've got the house, the car, the plane, the family, the second family, what else do you do, right? You might as well have a sports franchise. And in the States, they don't have the relegation factor, which I think changed a lot of the R word.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Which is harder to model. But I've always been shocked at how many of the rich guys that come into football think they're an instant expert in how to handle the transfer market and don't leave it to football manager or directors of football to do it, but want to micromanage it themselves. Cellinio at Leeds, you know, if you had let him, he would have cut the grass, right? He loved it so much. Certain owners are beyond super fans, right? They get obsessed with certain players, certain factors, and it's great. It's great to see it, but it makes them ill. Bill Kenwright was ill as a super fan at the end. You know, he had to stop going because it was going to kill him, okay? And you see that with certain owners, that it's really been detrimental to their health. I think the fans don't appreciate it sometimes. They pile in tens of millions of pounds or 50 million pounds or 100 million pounds, and the fans still hate them. That's
Laurie, I want to come back to what you said before about the Glazers.
Yes, sir.
So, for everybody listening, basically they use debt to buy the club and then pay down and finance that debt from the cash flow of Man United, who at the time were probably one of the few clubs that was throwing off cash. So here's my question to you. Now that we've got financial fair play, now that we see that a lot of them are throwing off cash, why don't we see loads and loads of financiers use that same structure to pick off every single club in Europe now?
They've slightly changed the rules. Okay, let's start with that. You can't use 100% debt financing to buy a club again. Okay, it wouldn't be allowed in the Premier League. Okay, it may be allowed lower down the leagues. It probably would be, but it's not allowed in the Premier League. The nearest I've seen to it in recent times was actually bizarrely in Italy with a very big Chinese group buying a very, very big Italian club. And they did 90% debt, 10% equity. Okay, so they put down 10% of the money in their own cash and they borrowed the rest against cash flow. Okay, but I would strongly suggest it. If you've got the free cash flow to do it, cap structure is critical, critical to optimizing your investment.
See, this is the point that I don't think anybody else, not at your level, understands. The cap structure is everything. You know, you can, and in this moment now, when you have got COVID has blown a huge hole in the finances of all of sport. We're not just talking about football. People that know the difference between debt and equity, know what a payment in kind is, that's able to structure something and put in procedures around making sure that cash flow remains positive. Surely this is the greatest investment scenario that we've seen in decades, Laurie.
We're all taught to try and buy low, sell high. Right?
Yep.
It's actually really, really hard to do psychologically. But I would argue that what has happened due to the COVID crisis has actually accelerated trends. A lot of clubs are growing fat and lazy just relying on TV money.
Okay. Yep.
And because of the TV money, they didn't have to do anything else. Right? Now, the trend is going to change. Arguably, what TV money will be or not be, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But I strongly believe, like super strongly believe, that if you can get good business management now, ice club now, you should make a fantastic return on your money. Okay. I'm not saying that it's always going to work all of the time, but the risk reward now is the best I think I've seen in my career.
Okay. That's my point. I agree with that. What I would say, Laurie, is to do that, you need to have the EQ to avoid all the classic mistakes. You know, if you get the coach wrong, that is almost a terminal mistake, because he's got his assistants. He'll bring in his favorite players. He'll use his favorite agent. Yes, we as financiers can look at a risk reward just now and say, wow, I could do this and get a really great return, especially if I use a strong level of debt, but I can also mess it up. So when you're advising people to take on clubs, what do you say to them about due diligence before and the team afterwards? Do you have a strong input into who they should be using for these procedures?
Yes. Now, I think in any new business where you come into it, you've got to have a 60, 180, 360-day plan. You've got to have a plan about what you're trying to achieve, because Rome isn't built in a day. You can't do everything in one go, in one hit. You want to have an evolution, not a revolution. Okay. And every club is in a slightly different position, right? You know, if you look at the catchment area of the Northeast, it is gagging for a big club, okay? Yeah. Everyone has always talked about Leeds as the big catchment area club as well, one city club and this kind of thing. And when you look at the structure of finance, okay, debt lenders care about one thing. Can you pay me back?
Yep.
Equity investors care about one thing. Can my equity grow? Okay.
Yep.
Can these two things work at the same time? Okay. That is about structuring your cash flow and having a sustainable business plan. Not, I think I'm going to find four kids in the academy. They're all going to be sold to Liverpool next 2 years. Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
You can't build a business based on believing you're a better small cap youngster picker than the other 91 clubs out there, let alone the Scots or the Irish or the Welsh or anybody.
Or the Portuguese or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, the Portuguese factory trade has been spectacular. Benfica is the most profitable club in Europe. They had the results 2 months ago. There is one guy at Benfica that works off a spectacular model that made €1 billion from player trading in 8 years. Demonstrable track record using zero equity.
Yeah. No, this is my point. And I've got one last question before I pass over to my colleagues, because I think this is something that, again, people would like to hear. The amount of receivables, whether that's from broadcast, whether it's from sponsors, or whether it's, as you say, from transfer fees that are on the balance sheets of sports clubs, let's call it football clubs to make it easier, is huge. Now, this is an area where the big banks have got involved in the past and they've offered to factor those receivables. But I guess they probably are withdrawing from the market a little bit just now. Yeah. If they are, what is taking their place, Laurie? Because that cash, that working capital needs to get freed up.
Yeah. I mean, just for any of the people listening that don't understand what this is, right? Football receivables are basically where a club is owed money from a player transfer or a sponsorship deal, and it's paid over a period of time. So to give a classic example, Manchester United by Bruno Fernandes from Sporting Lisbon. Sporting Lisbon's in Portugal. They're not as rich as Benfica by any stretch. In fact, they're a bit of, let's just say, going through a financial restructuring or six. They want the 50 million in one go. Manchester United, like everyone in COVID period, wants to stretch their cash. So they want to pay it over a 3 or 4 year period. A bank will step in and say, right, Sporting Lisbon, we'll give you all the money in one clip. We'll take the IOUs from Manchester United for the next 2, 3, 4 years, but we'll charge you this amount of interest rate.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how football finance works. Yep. Vodafone is sponsoring your club for 5 years. You want the money on day one. Someone else gives you the money and charges you an interest rate. Okay. So it fits both parties, and it's a function of cost of capital and risk. Okay. When COVID hit, the risk went up. Was football ever going to come back? Then are we all going to live, right? But it started predominantly as a defensive thing. Okay. In the UK, there were 2 or 3 major banks that did it. And bizarrely, in the UK, UK to UK transfers are protected by the Football Creditors Act. So even if there was a bankruptcy, crazy, you were protected. Right. Yeah. It's quite an incredible rule.
It's unbelievable.
So the interest rates became unrealistically cheap. Okay. COVID's hit. Every bank has now shrunk its balance sheet. Every investment credit committee is going, sorry, you want us to lend money to football? You've got to be kidding. Right. So the amount of available capital shrank at exactly the time the clubs, for cash flow reasons, are now thinking, crikey, we've got no income. We've got no season tickets being sold. We've got no sponsors looking at us like they used to. How do we get income in? Oh, let's factor some receivables. So you've got an increase in demand at exactly the moment there's a decrease of supply of capital. Okay. So the price of that has gone up, and it's gone up quite dramatically. The early years was all involved with third party ownership as well. Okay. Yep. You know, very famous sort of cases with Arsenal and Boris Berezovsky's and people like that. It's Tevez and Mascherano, basically. It's still a very big business for party ownership, but that's probably for a whole different
world.
But again, it's about lowering the cost for the clubs. Okay. If you're a club, your biggest cost is your players, right? You know, if you think back 3 years ago, football was bust. Okay. £3 billion a year came into it from Sky and BT. £2.5 billion of that went to the Premier League. 86.5% of that went on players' wages and bonuses.
Yep.
Name any
it's
other
financial business. Fair play.
Name any, exactly. Now it's $8.7 billion. It's big money, right? The wages haven't doubled or tripled. And I think a lot of clubs, if they act economically prudently, can use this environment to cut their costs. Right?
Yeah, I agree.
And they should. Every other business is doing it, every bank's doing it. All the big four accounting firms are doing it. It's speeding up the natural cycle where sport can become sustainable. Okay. You know, even Formula One's doing it, right? If there is any Formula One ever again or any team, but, right? But I think it just accelerates what was a trend. Okay. Will we see £100 million transfer this summer?
No.
There's only going to be one, and that'll be Neymar, in my opinion. Okay. You know, if he goes back to Barcelona, that will be a big deal. But they'll probably do it as a partial player swap deal. Okay. Because Barcelona's finances aren't in great shape either.
They're not in great shape. No.
So there's a lot of, like anybody, when the water goes out, you're seeing who's naked, a lot of balance sheets are stretched. There'll be a lot more debt being placed, but it's got more expensive. But it's very, very necessary. And to service that, the clubs must run themselves as a business. Every time you issue a debt term sheet, you ask for a copy of their business plan. If they don't have a sustainable business plan, they won't get the debt. It's not about price. They won't get the debt. So it's making clubs fess up to be a business, which in the medium and long term is great. It's the right way for football to be, right? In the old days, you just went to your local Barclays bank.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I struggle to see any Barclays banks around at the moment.
Laurie, let me ask you something, because what I'm hearing here is fascinating, because on the one hand, you've identified what you think is maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity in, yep, in this business, right, to buy. And on the other hand, you've got the cost of capital going up at precisely the time when the people that have access to it must be rubbing their hands in glee. So just if you can, help us understand, if you're sitting down and you've got all the access to capital that you need, what do you look for in a potential target? Just run us through the criteria that you would look for. Anything that would strike a club out immediately, anything that would really kind of draw you in to look at maybe working to see if the numbers work.
I think personally, it's all in the plan. Numbers are numbers are numbers. All right, Grant, you know, you've been a money guy. You know, they'll all show you a nice little 45-degree line, okay?
Yeah, of course.
I've never seen anyone. Hockey stick, V shape. You know, we've got the whole book of cliches, and I've got a lot of scar tissue on my back from following them, right?
Yeah.
The business needs to be sustainable on the pitch and off the pitch, right? You need to have a plan on the pitch. What's your style of play going to be? Never be beholden to a manager. I wouldn't back a business with a superstar manager.
Fascinating.
Okay. I think personally, when you look at who has been the most economically, let's say the most value creating managers in the Premier League in the last 5 years, who would you think it is?
Pochettino.
Pochettino, probably, yeah. You would think he'd be up there, certainly.
Okay. What? So Spurs' valuation, they put £1 billion into the stadium. What do you think they're worth?
As a club valuation now, I would say...
And bearing in mind, you're an Arsenal fan asking us, so
I would say,
there's a discount there.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say two billion.
Okay. And where do you think it was worth before they put up the stadium?
£2 billion.
So it's created no value?
I don't think so.
Right. So I would say, if you don't mind me saying, and it's a moot point because I don't know what the right answer is. I do know numbers-wise what it is, and it would have been Jurgen Klopp, actually. The second biggest,
right?
And I could show you exactly the numbers modelled, would have been a bloke called David Wagner.
From Huddersfield.
He got Huddersfield promoted with no money. But the most incredible thing he did, he got them to stay up for a year with no money.
Yeah.
That was extraordinary, right? Secondly, I would argue Roy Hodgson. There was the season a couple of years ago. Remember when Crystal Palace didn't even have a shot?
Had that awful start. Yeah.
He came in. Everyone thought it was going to be a disaster. He's 50 years older than the oldest player, and he kept them up. Right. And that was an amazing piece of value save for Crystal Palace. Right. But in terms of where do I look? You've got to have a plan, right? I'm a big believer in this KYC approach on your fan. I would stick in multi-load streaming on every club. Okay. You've got to help people do not do that in sport. Staggers me that they just are not interacting with a hugely loyal customer base. Probably the most loyal thing in the thing that makes sport attractive to businesses is nobody changes their football club after the age of 10.
No.
And I think 7% of fans spend 94% of the revenue. Okay. So how do you find your super fans and how do you create them? Okay. So you go and take techniques from LVMH, Burberry, Cartier, take luxury good techniques and apply them to football. Okay. As an outsider, I'm not biased by plagiarizing what you see in general industry, but those guys are relentless at selling you the next handbag and they know their customers.
Absolutely.
They just know it. You get sent stuff. They are on it. In football, they send you an email, right?
Well, and more importantly, they want to hear. The fan wants to hear from them in a way that you don't want to hear from an insurance company.
Exactly. There's a whole universe of companies that should be reaching out at this stage to access this because now clubs need it. So that's what I mean about you've got to have a right business plan. You've got to have the people on board to execute it. I love meeting ex-football players at clubs. I find it fantastic. I want to go and have a drink with them. I think they're great, but I wouldn't want them in charge of the wallet.
Yeah, right.
Okay, because it's just the wrong way. Managers that don't understand how to play the strategy, get rid of them immediately. Okay, they don't own the business, don't have the manager running the club or manipulating the media. Okay, and some of the very high-profile ones, let's just say, are quite notorious at this, and you can almost see their handwriting in the newspapers.
Okay? Yeah.
I think twinning and globalization for the bigger clubs. What's your strategy? Who are you twinning with? How are you going global? How are you diversifying your income stream? What's your
plan? That's how what you're seeing with Inter Miami.
Correct. And how do you get more stadium occupancy? Right? How do you use your big assets? Why do you use your pitch 24 times a year and not 120 times a year? Americans can't get their head around this. Why is the hallowed turf, which is now 70% plastic, used so little, right? Why do you sell so few shirts? Why do you not resell your tickets? Okay, it's just there's just so many little things where you can see the business management is not run as a business plan. And I apply a little bit of investment banking techniques on it. Incentivize people all the way. Most people that work in football clubs do not have a good incentive channel. You need salespeople to go out and really sell the sponsorship, not just go through the motions of selling the sponsorship. And therefore, you've got to arm them to do it. So that's the bit I focus on more than anything else, is have they got a real sustainable plan to make the club profitable? Okay? If you have the
Laurie, this takes us all back a bit to the start around chess and certainly poker. One of the real challenges for investing in sport, it's a little bit like Harold Macmillan, you know, what's the hardest part of the job? Events, dear boy. So game theory. How do you apply game theory to buying a business that has got so many variables? A player marries the wrong girl and never plays again. He gets into the wrong crowd and gets dependency on drugs. As game theory, how do you insert that into your investment framework?
It's a great question. Have you watched that trial of Aaron Fernandez on Netflix?
Yes.
New England Patriots knew this guy was a problem, and yet they carried on with him. You know, it's quite incredible how much people will forgive a star player.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because the power of that merchandising and the ad is just amazing. In terms of variables, that's why sport is so compelling, because you just don't know. Okay. I think the spread of the the cost of sales of staff is ridiculously skewed at the moment to players. If you look at most football clubs' wage bill, you'll see it's in the high 90s on players and 1, 2, or 3% on sports staff. Well, you get what you pay for. You know, if you want to get a job to come and work for you and sort your sponsorship out, you're going to have to pay it. Okay. You know, if you want people that will just send you rubbish stuff, then pay them nothing, right? You need experts. This isn't, it's an evolving business. It's not static. And you need people that understand that and can sell it. Okay. When I look at most of the businesses, they're well-intentioned young kids that tend to work in the administration side on football.
Yeah.
Okay. They're great and they're enthusiastic and whatever. But if I'm going to pitch an FCMG or a Dow 30 company, they want to see someone that knows what they're talking about. They want to have an adult conversation and they want to see data, all the way data. And if you haven't got the tools to do that, you aren't going to get it. And if you aren't going to get it, people say, oh, the business and non-business side, they're separate, they're run by separate. They're actually linked. Success on the pitch makes success in sponsorship. 4 years ago, Liverpool had no sponsorship in China. They had Standard Chartered as a sponsor. They had no sponsorship in China. Okay, they went for a big Indonesia sponsor, and their strategy for Asia was kind of all skewed. Okay, they were in talks, they were selling, they weren't selling, Fosun, you know, who knows, right? But they've addressed it. Spurs obviously made a very big push into the States, really haven't gone hard into Asia. Okay, they, you know, everyone has to do things they think is sensible. But when I look at how you can approach it, you've got to invest in high quality people off the pitch, and you've got to invest in the tools to help them succeed. It's no good just layering them in, right? And that bit, it's surprising how many very successful and wealthy people don't do it. They just don't do it. And in fact, it's probably, you know, apart from maybe City that are really going for it, it's hard to think of a group in Europe that is. When I go and visit sports franchises in the States, they've all got a tech accelerator. They've got a venture capital business. Yeah. They've got a tie with a university. They've got a twinning in 82 different local clubs. They've got a junior academy. They give away freebies to kids that come to the games. You know, what do you get? What do you get in the UK?
So, Laurie, when you watched Sunderland Till I Die, which I'm sure you did, and again, everything you're saying just reinforces my just straight up consternation at how what you talk about is so practical, so simple, and so applicable across any business, but there seems to be this blind spot in football. When you talk about these top quality people, what did you think when you watched Sunderland Till I Die, particularly that second season, when you saw, you know, kind of the hope come in, and it looked to me, and I can't do it, so I'm in a greenhouse throwing bricks, but it looked like it was just poorly managed to me, and they had the wrong people in place, pure and simple, to me.
It's great. I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was beautifully shot.
Yeah, no, as did I.
The music was good. I thought the cameras were great. And the Fulwell guys, I think, did an amazing job, Gabe and Tim. Okay? When I watched it, I just thought the margins between success and failure are so small. They lost that one key game at Wembley, right?
Yeah.
The story would have been totally different. Totally different. I think it was really hard yards watching the owner doing that transfer negotiation right at the end, but he's listening to the football guys. I just wanted to cry because I think we've all seen it. But that felt really raw. But you know, it was that close. I think it was thoroughly enjoyable car crash television in a way. What do I think they could have done better? I try not to judge those sort of things on a TV program because it's great TV, but is that representative of what's really happened? I don't know. I'm not there, right?
Laurie, I've got one last question for you. Thinking of everything that you've said here about what is needed in the team and the skills that are needed, my thoughts now in this moment of clubs all looking to, you know, hunker down towards their core competence, which is on the football side. Surely this is a great moment for somebody to put together an outsourcing company for sports clubs, not just football clubs, sports clubs, to take care of the data, the commercial, the sponsorship, the media, the content. Isn't this a great moment for somebody to dominate that?
I think it's a brilliant idea. It happens in the hedge fund world. Hedge funds outsource their trading, they outsource their research. They outsource their marketing, and hedge funds are seen as probably the smartest money in finance, and they outsource most of the fixed costs now. I think it's a great idea. I think the fixed cost overhead of having expensive people there to get you to be successful is probably completely unnecessary, because there's times they're going to be intensely used and times they won't be. You know, there's a lot of seasonality about marketing and business, especially in sport. So I actually think that's a great idea for lots of logical reasons. I'd say especially for mid-sized clubs that know they've got a big audience and a big business. So football's a complicated business, right? There's a lot of things that go on in it that all can lose you money. Very few of them are offensive And most of the business management teams are defensive. And that's a really hard way to buy a club. And this is why I spend way too much time with people about their business strategy, why they're buying. Why do you really want to buy this? What do you think you're going to make? What are you going to add to it? What are you going to build from it? What's the purpose? And I always think that if you get the business plan right, it's like decorating a room. You know, 80% of it, 85% is preparation. You put the paint up right at the end, right? You've got to get everything else right. And if you prepare it right, if you hit a bump in the road, you're ready for it.
That's game theory.
It's classic game theory, but it's actually pretty straightforward logic, right? But you've got to have a crisis management team ready at all times, okay? Same as you would do in any takeover, right? In any deal, every move you make will lead to two or three outcomes. Out of those two or three outcomes, everything will have another path and another path and another path. And you should just assign probabilities to it. Yeah, and if the odds don't add up, and if the odds don't add up high enough, don't do it. Don't do it 51-49 like a poker player. You've got to be 85-15. And if you're not, miss it. Right? Just say, I can't pay that price. I don't want to do that deal like this. Oh, you want to hive out the stadium? No interest. Okay.
But that's exactly what we saw in that transfer negotiation you talked about, right? At the Sunderland thing. It's exactly what we saw. You know, I wouldn't pay more than whatever it was for him, and he ended up paying almost double what the manager had said to him, right? And it's classic, exactly what you just said. And he fell into the trap, hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, well, he ran out of time, didn't he? That was the problem. Yeah. He was right on transfer day. And that's been a well-known tactic used by certain agents that are just trying to max out for their clients, you know, that it's a bit of the game for me is know your customer, know your opponent.
Yeah.
And just don't get yourself into that position. You know, doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, don't do it.
Don't do that. Right? Exactly.
Do something else.
For them.
Okay. But you've got to try. You've got to try. And I felt for Donald there because he didn't see it coming. Okay. A professional director of football would have seen that coming.
Would absolutely would.
100%.
Okay, yeah,
Saw it coming.
Yeah, and I don't see that personal to him, and I don't mean it in any personal disrespect to him. I think it happens to a lot of owners, and it happens in life, right? But you know what? You've got to be man enough to say, nope, enough. Okay?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, Laurie, it's been fascinating. I think we've already uncovered at least two other topics that we can sit and have a completely separate discussion on. And hopefully you'll be gracious enough to come back and do that, because this has been an awful lot of fun and fascinating. I think it's going to kind of lift the curtain for a lot of people into how a lot of this stuff works, which is, you know, it's a very arcane world, but it's so important for people to try and get their heads around. So I can't thank you enough for sharing that with us and sharing your insight, because it's been brilliant.
It's a pleasure, mate. And thanks, guys. Good questions, by the way. Interesting. Very interesting the way you guys look at it.
Laurie.
You know,
excellent. Really, really good. No, my pleasure, and love the speed chess for money. That you don't get any sharper end of the market than that, mate. So, and then 3 months in Vegas on poker, my kind of guy.
Vegas is reopening, guys. We need a football team out there, and if that's my one red miss thing. Someone needs to back me to do a football club out there.
You've got the NFL team. I mean, I was there last year, and the stadium is right at the end of the strip. That'll be ready. I guess it should have been ready this year, but whether they'll play, I presume they'll play. Football's too big to not play.
Yeah, yeah. And they've got the hockey out there as well. It's ice hockey.
Yeah, exactly right. And they battled above their weight, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, look, Laurie, again, thanks so much. And next time we'll do this over a beer with some of those friends we have in common.
Sounds good. Grant, great. And thanks, guys.
Right. Take care.
Thanks, Laurie.
Thank you, Laurie.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I've got to say, lads, that was fascinating. You know, I've long had this complete inability to understand what it is about sport in general, but seemingly football in particular, that blinds businessmen. And, you know, it's great to know that I'm not going mad, you know, and Laurie sees it. He obviously is a smart businessman who isn't blinded like so many are. But isn't it just fascinating, Rog, how this game can do this to people?
Yeah, I don't know where to start there. I mean, I hope people have got an idea of some of the thinking that goes behind everything you read in the papers. And listen, I've seen it many times, Grant. I've seen all versions of very smart business people come into a league, buy a club. You sit down with them in month one and it's a very interesting conversation. You see them in 6 months later, they're looking tired, they're looking frazzled, they're looking for a short-term win to get the pressure off their back. I think a lot of it, Grant, comes down to short-termism, and I don't think most folk realise what that means. You know, yeah. I've seen guys in the boardroom at halftime and their team's getting beat and they know what it's going to be at the end of the game and the week that's coming, and you see the blood drain from their face. So I'm somebody that's never going to really say, well, why don't you do it this way? This is the way that you would do it in perfect game theory. It is events, dear boy. That is football. That is sport. And, you know, the fascinating thing is trying to match that short-termism with what is today long-term financing cap table structures, Grant. That's the real trick.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely right. And obviously, you know, it's something that you two guys have banged on about in week in, week out on this podcast is the importance of data.
Well, it was great to hear a banker and a financier like that talk the language that Roger and I have been talking about, which is, in order to make sport commercially viable, the game needs to be changed, of which, as he talked about, data is at the key, both on and off the field. And that was music to my ears, because that is the yellow brick road for sport right now.
Agreed. You know what was interesting about Laurie? Very clearly an old school merchant banker, more than investment banker. Old city boy, the way that you used to see a lot of guys that were like that, sharp as a tack, knew how to make a deal, knew how to hustle. And now everybody is on algorithms and, you know, momentum trading. And I just thought that was really refreshing to get somebody that I kind of like grew up. That's the profile of guy that I saw when I was in the city. And I'm sure you're the same, Grant. Now applying those skills to the football industry.
Well, you know, Roger, it is interesting because, yes, Laurie and I share the same cohort, right? We have a lot of, as it turns out, a lot of mutual friends in common who all kind of grew up in the City of London back in the 80s. But what's fascinating to me is guys like Laurie who grew up in a period and amongst a peer group who, you know, data was not that important, right? You lived and died with your wits and your smarts and your on the seat of your pants. And it's guys like Laurie who've managed to adapt from that environment and embrace this new world we live in where data is so important, because many haven't, right? I mean, it just explains why Laurie continues to be successful, because many of those guys that, and again, my era, have failed to do that, and he's done it supremely well.
Yeah, well said.
Well, another great week is in the books. Our thanks to Laurie Pinto for sharing his time and his experience with us. I thought it was a fascinating conversation. Our thanks to you, as always, for listening. Please do rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It really does help us, and share it amongst your friends. And please follow us again next week. If you want to chat with us in the meantime, you'll find us on Twitter at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And you'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And you'll find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, as always, have a pleasant week.